I am just delighted to be here today with Dr. Stephen Iacoboni. And I've been reading his book. I'm almost finished with Telos by Stephen Iacoboni. He is a doctor. He's an award-winning cancer researcher, keynote speaker at oncology conferences, and community hospital cancer center director at four locations in the Pacific Northwest over his 40-year career. He's also the author of the highly acclaimed Cancer Care Spiritual Journal, The Undying Soul, as well as being the author of Telos. And as you all know, the title would captivate me because we've talked about that so many times on the channel. And I'd like to get started by asking Dr. Iacoboni to tell me a little bit about your background and what led you into researching this idea of Telos.
Well, thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here. If you were Sherlock Holmes and you spent 2 minutes with me, you would say, okay, your name is Iacoboni and you were born in the 50s. Therefore, you were raised Roman Catholic. And you listen to my voice and know that I don't have an accent. So you were raised Roman Catholic. And because everyone who was Italian in those days was, and my four grandparents were immigrants from Italy, and my parents were therefore second generation Italian Americans. Everyone went to church in those days. Divorce was more or less unheard of, and I was a devout Catholic. For better or for worse, I like to think perhaps providentially, I was willingly misled by what was called the biochemical revolution of the 70s. When DNA was discovered, and I was a biochemist at the time. Oh, and I was an orphan. My parents were both dead by the time I was 22. My father died when I was 11. And so I lacked certain guidance, although, again, I'm not making excuses. I'm just laying out the history. And I went to medical school in Berkeley, California. I was an award-winning scientist. And if you wanted to be climb the academic ladder, you had to embrace what was then becoming the newly articulated scientific atheism, which is that we all knew by 1975 that life is a chemical reaction that starts with some molecules we call DNA that make proteins that make life. This happened by accident, according to Charles Darwin. And if you don't believe that or understand that, you're stupid. And I again was willingly misled by that. To find meaning in my life, I decided to confront the cancer that killed my mother, and I became an oncologist, and I went to the top cancer center in the world at MD Anderson. I became a professor, and I became disillusioned rather quickly because we weren't making much progress, and I had this love for treating patients as opposed to doing research. And that's just a personal thing. There are great researchers there, and in order to thrive in that climate and be content in that climate, you have to have love research. I love being at the bedside for hours with my patients. And so the chief of the department, who was a good friend of mine, Emil Freirich, said, go ahead and go out into private practice. It's okay. And so with his blessing, I did. And I ended up getting as far away from academia and metro as I could. I went to a small rural town in eastern Washington. I was a West Coaster. Had done California very thoroughly. I wanted to be in Washington State. So I was in Walla Walla, Washington, which is now a wine capital. And I started the cancer center there. And I thought, okay, I don't understand death. I don't really understand life the way I thought I did. I thought that life was a chemical reaction. You take certain chemicals to destroy the thing that's inhibiting life, called chemotherapy, and the cancer goes away and life goes on. And then you die gracefully much later in life, and none of that seemed to be happening. So, in some ways, I secretly wanted my patients to show me faith that I somehow could not intellectually grasp. And they did. And that's basically why I say that there's must have been some providence involved because they rescued me from my own intellectual delusion. The other thing that happened was since 1970, 1980, when we all were convinced that life was a chemical reaction, so much science has come through since then to overturn that utterly simplistic, really kind of puerile notion. We now understand that life is complex beyond imagination and beyond description. And yes, you can tease out this or that chemical reaction, which is sort of like feeling an elephant like a blind man and saying that an elephant is a trunk because that's all you can feel. You know, the Zen problem for that. And so I thought, I prided myself on searching the truth. If you're familiar with Anthony Flew, who is probably the most important apologist for atheism in the 20th century, when he finally turned back to God, he said, "I'm just following the truth. And I thought atheism was correct, and now I know I'm wrong." And he wrote that book in, I think, 2005, There Is a God. I hadn't read his book, but I followed the same path, which was, am I missing something here? And then I realized, well, you know, you thought that you were going to cure cancer with chemicals and you failed. So maybe there's something missing in your paradigm. And then if you study science and the history of science, there are paradigms that fail all the time or that they're only partial. Even Newton's laws are only accurate up to a certain point. They don't apply to small things like atoms. They don't apply to large things like stars and black holes. So I followed all the science carefully. And what came out was chaos theory, which became complexity theory. And then I had to admit that I didn't understand life except in an extremely rudimentary way, and became searching more and more. And then what I finally realized was that there's something missing from the paradigm of science in general, and in particular biology. And the problem is between the physical sciences, chemistry and physics, and the natural or the life sciences of biology, botany, zoology. In fact, the word biology, if you ask 100 scientists the origin of the word, it's not biology, it's bi, meaning the two worlds, the inorganic world and the organic world. And Lamarck named biology, probably the most important biologists of the first half of the 19th century, gave biology a name before it had a name. And he said, there are two worlds. There's a living world and there's an inanimate world. Studying the living world is the opposite of the physics, and so we'll call it biology. Anyway, you can get very, very far studying chemistry and physics to understand things. That is, until you can't, you know, and now they're all tangled up in entanglement and dark matter and dark energy, which are the oxymorons of oxymorons. Their paradigm is failing, and I'm not trying to be critical. All paradigms fail because they're just constructs, and you have to realize that there is no construct for your soul or your heart. They're only constructs for physics, for science. And so the physicists now, of course, don't understand dark energy, dark matter, entanglement, just to name a few of their little problems. But in biology, the rules are different. And the problem is that science began with chemistry and physics and astronomy, Galileo, Copernicus, Newton. And scientists have said, okay, we're going to follow these great scientists of the past when we study biology. Well, that made sense up to a point, but they didn't realize they were stuck in a paradigm that may not apply. And so the rules of physics, the rules of chemistry only go so far in biology. And there have to be completely different governing principles. And you don't have to take my word for it. The greatest, well, let's say the top five physicists in the history of physics, Erwin Schrödinger, famous for the equation that defines quantum mechanics, after which it is named. He said in his book, biology has a whole different set of laws and a whole different set of rules. He said this in 1946.
Mm-hmm.
And until you understand these new laws or discover them, you'll never understand biology. And he said that 80 years ago. And yet people pressed on with the physics and chemistry until we finally are up against the wall, and we see a ball of twine we can't untangle, and that there's something going on in life that is undefinable. And so I started reading things that I was told not to read, things that were written by the people who started the intelligent design movement in the 90s. Michael Behe's Irreducible Complexity and Stephen Meyer's Specified Complexity and William Dembski's Complexity Inference. And I could not refute these things. But what really turned the corner for me was this book written by a great mathematician who was an avowed agnostic, and even with his agnosticism, came to the conclusion that without telos, you don't have life. What's interesting in the world of science is that you
come... Is that the chapter on Robert Rosen that you're talking about there?
Yes, yes. What's interesting about science in general, it's certainly true in this case, is that if you decide you want to be a biologist or a physicist, you go to physics school and physics graduate school, and you're taught by the people who had created the paradigms, and you are stuck in, you're in the paradigm, and you hardly ever look outside of it, and you don't really need to, and you're told not to. And so if you think about the great discoveries in the history of the world, like, for example, Einstein, he was told, we don't need any more physicists, we're done. Physics is finished. And so Einstein sat outside of the ivory tower, and as a postal clerk, he invented relativity, some little thing like that. Quantum mechanics was out there waiting to be discovered, but it took a long time. Edwin Hubble was told that the Milky Way is the only galaxy, and there's no point in setting up your big microscope because you're not going to find anything. Well, he only discovered the Big Bang and everything. So if you're outside of a paradigm, you're not constrained by what you think are the lanes you need to stay in. And so Robert Rosen was a mathematician, but he loved biology. And he returned to biology because, like some others, some other physicists like Stephen Hawking and Leonard Susskind and so on, John Polkinghorne, they have said, well, you know, you biologists can't figure out the answers you're trying to solve. And so smart people will take a stab at it. And so Robert Rosen looked at everything and he said, your paradigm is just incomplete. You can't reduce biology to chemical reactions because there's no way for these chemical reactions to come into existence without another chemical reaction that didn't exist in the first place. And he said the only possible way that life can exist as we know it is that if there's some organizing principle that makes it happen that is yet defined. Oh, wait. Aristotle defined it 2,400 years ago. He called it telos, meaning that everything in biology is designed for a purpose. And remember, Aristotle's walking around in a robe on dirt roads, no microscopes, no slide rules, no electricity, no anything. And he could look at the natural world undistracted by all those things. And he said, you know, the hoof of a horse is really perfectly designed for what horses do, whereas the feet of a dog or a cat are perfectly designed for what they do. And what's really interesting is that cats retract their claws when they run, and because they don't need their claws to run, and their claws are curved, unlike the straight claws of a dog. So dog doesn't have to retract their feet. And oh, by the way, they have little leather pads on the bottom of their feet, so they don't need shoes the way humans do. Well, that's really something. And look at the shape of the ear. It's like a funnel. It's that brings the sound right into the hole that takes the sound. Well, that's strange, interesting. And you know that other than humans, all other vertebrates have four limbs, because that is the perfect ergonomic solution to traveling across the earth. In fact, humans don't go very far on their 2 feet. They have to have wagons and horses and things, but that's okay. We can make those things. But a dog can't make his own wagon, but four legs is just what you need, of course, unless you're a bird and you have wings, which is even better. Now, my goodness, the shape of a wing is curved so that you get lift by the differential airflow over the top and bottom of the wing. Well, it's pretty, pretty interesting. How the heck did that happen? Then he said, I don't know why it's like this. But the fact is, everything in nature is designed for a purpose. And you cannot take any organism, human to bacterium, take any bit of that creature, including humans, and say, well, my lips, my nose, my eyelids, my ear, my whiskers, my toes. All of those things are absolutely necessary to fulfill some purpose that allows you to live. And so what you see is that, unlike landslides and waterfalls and hurricanes and erosion and falling stars, the things that happen to organisms, everything is purpose driven. And the science of physics and chemistry are completely absent that factor. Now, it was purposely left out because it was felt purposely. There you go. Play on words. Sorry. It was purposely left out because it was felt that purpose was too hard to define. Excuse me.
Well, so let me just ask a question here, though. I could listen to an atheist evolutionist say that whole list of physical qualities that you just laid out for all the animals and all of that. And then they would say, isn't evolution wonderful? Because they can look at that and they can see in that the evolutionary process of developing the survival of the fittest that can meet the necessity of natural selection to produce something that is going to make that, you know, we get progress, we get evolutionary progress, and animals are getting better and better. So they would make, they would just take that and use the same data, but then switch the picture, right?
My answer will surprise you, I think.
Okay.
I agree with them. Here's the difference. And I say this in the book. Evolution, as far as we know, again, because we can't see it in real time, it's all inferential from the fossil record. But the evidence is so overwhelming as to be beyond dispute. Evolution, as far as we know, is a fact. It's not the what, it's the how. So you could take a Boeing jetliner or your son's tricycle or your toaster, and you say, this thing looks like it's fulfilling a purpose. I wonder where it came from. And you would say, well, some engineer designed it. The problem is the how, and that is where it's all about, because it is interesting, in fact, that what you said is true, but you left out the backstory, which is that the scientists for decades and decades denied purpose until they finally had to concede and go, yeah, I guess you're right. Kidneys really are there to filter toxins. The purpose of the lungs really is to help you respire and breathe in oxygen and remove CO2. But we had always said that those things are just sort of there and they just happen to do what they do. And as a result, you're alive. But they've had to change their whole argument because smart people and just people with common sense were so that's ridiculous. And so they've backed way off. They've come over into our corner. We call it atheism of the gaps, which is widening and widening. And so, yes, they concede that. And then the question is, how did it get there? And so they have already offered their answer to how that gets there, which is that it was random, accidental, and lucky. And this is why the astrophysicists Hawking and Stephen Hawking, Leonard Susskind, Martin Rees, the great astrophysicists of the 20th century, and Polkinghorne, all astrophysicists, said, okay, well, you're talking about mathematics and stuff, and so let's take a look at this. And these great intellectual mathematician astrobiologists, we'd like to think of them as the smartest scientists, they all said it may have been accidental, but only in an infinite world of 10 to the 500 universes, which is a fantasy. And it could not have happened just on one world in the 5 billion years you give for the planet's existence. So these atheist scientists, Polkinghorne is not an atheist. He's the exception. He's saying there aren't 10 to the 500 universes. Of course there aren't. he just said that, but they said the biology, these biologists are kind of bad at math. That's why they're biologists. They cut up things and they put little pins into organs and they say, ooh, look, it's a kidney and that's the iliac artery. Okay, that's fine. But they can't solve a differential equation. We really smart physicists have said that what they're talking about is stupid. And they say it. And if you don't believe me, you can read the book by Susskind, something landscape. And then Martin Rees's Just Seven Numbers and Stephen Hawking's The Grand Design. They're all scientific atheists, but they all say it didn't happen the way the biologists say it happened. They're wrong. They don't say they're stupid, but they're basically saying, oh, your entire paradigm is this? Well, it's wrong, which means you're stupid.
And their argument for that was that the probabilities just don't work out in the amount of time that we have in the universe.
Well, exactly. It's all about that. I mean, again, this is all we are inferring that there was a single cell formed 3-4 billion years ago. Even that is impossible statistically. But even if that happened, that the single cell becoming a human being a billion years, which is when where animals appeared, actually 500 million years ago, it's just not possible. And so there are ways to imagine this or think about it in ways that are not so technical. But if you can imagine a junkyard with any number of pieces of junk in it, and a hurricane blows through, and when hurricane passes, that all the junk got put into something that was a 747 jetliner with 100 million pieces all connected to 100 million other things, so that the connections are 10 to the 10th, and that just happened because the wind blew through. Now, it had to happen a lot of times until it happened. It's just, you know, you can't believe that. Or here's the other way to think about it. Every human being you talk to or look at or think about, they began their life as a single cell with 46 chromosomes, daddy's sperm and mommy's egg. And that single cell, this is all facts, so you can't say I'm making something up. That single cell grew and divided into a full baby with 25 trillion cells. Now, okay, if you divide something, if you take two, and you take two to the second, the third, the fourth, you can get up to a trillion. But those 25 trillion cells aren't just sitting in a pile. There are trillions and trillions and trillions of connections that have to be just right for the baby to come out of the womb and start crying and suckling. You have 10 billion neurons in your brain. That's a big number. But every neuron is connected to another neuron and another neuron. There are 10 trillion synapses between the 10 billion neurons in your brain. And you're telling me that this one cell had within it the information to make 10 trillion perfect synapses without which you would be having seizures or dementia or psychosis or coma? You can't describe any of that by the laws of physics or chemistry, period, end. And you can't describe how a paramecium turned into an elephant over 500,000 years, period, end. It can't be done. There are no steps. I mean, the steps are astronomical. And so the whole idea that it came about accidentally and without something to drive it purposefully is ridiculous. And so that when Rosen said it, and he said, I'm an agnostic, so I don't know what to think about this, but I have to look at the facts and say, there has to be something, some other force that drives us. And Rosen wrote about Schrodinger. That's how I heard about Schrodinger. I knew about Schrodinger because I studied physics. And he said, Schrodinger said this in 1946. After the war, and he was a German hiding out in Ireland because he hated Hitler. He was able to come out of the closet and start writing and stuff again. Anyway, the paradigm is in utter collapse. And what is left to explain the fact of evolution is that everything that goes on in biology is purpose driven. And that's the theme of my book, the scientific basis, not some whimsical, I'm Aristotle, it just seems purpose driven, or my mentor spiritually, St. Thomas Aquinas, who said, I agree with Aristotle, everything is ordered to its end. And he made it as a matter of reason, not faith. Just look around you. But now in 21st century science, the science says, it says it loud and clear, it's purpose-driven. And if it's purpose-driven, there has to be a reason behind purpose. Purpose does not come out of the inanimate world. It never does. Landslides and sinkholes and earthquakes are not there because the gods wanted to destroy a part of the Philippines with a tornado. Or out there, they call them typhoons, it's the same thing. or bury a town in Lima with a landslide from a volcano. The god of the volcano used to think that. No, it just happened because of physical forces. Okay. But there's nothing purposeful about any of it except to create life. And so the fundamental, remember, the atheists had to overcome what was the reigning paradigm of the middle of the 19th century, which is that everything is designed. It's obvious. Everything's designed. I mean, look around you. You think that everything's going on. You have intimate relations with a woman and a man, and out comes a baby in 9 months who later becomes your son and your daughter and takes over the farm later, and it's just all happened. No, of course, it rains. We have seasons. The seasons all serve a purpose so that we can have crops and so on, and we can reason and just understand these things. Everyone understood that. Everyone believed that until that paradigm got overthrown by the silliness of, oh, this purpose was never really there. It was imagined, like, it looks like the sun is going around the earth, but you were wrong about that. the earth is actually going around the sun, and the earth is spinning. And silly you Christians, you have silly thoughts. But we're here to save you from your silliness. Well, now we see that the facts are that they're the ones that are silly, because there is no way to account for the scientific fact of purpose in life without saying there is a designer.
Well, I wonder if you could say a word about Rosen's word that he uses is entailment. I wonder if you could explain that for my listeners, because I thought that was really interesting.
It's very interesting. I had not seen that word till I read his book, although now I've seen it now in some older writings in the 19th centuries, when I'm going back to the paradigms lost, to coin a phrase. entailment is a noun made out of an adjective or a verb. So what does that entail, which is an adverb, or what? How do you entail something to happen? Entail means how to make something happen. And you say, what is entailed, or what is the entailment, is how do you make something come about? What is required? So I say in my book, if you are going to go camping in the snow, what would that plan entail with respect to the equipment? You wouldn't have shorts and a t-shirt. You'd have a sturdy tent and a shovel and a stove and waterproof clothing and boots and food that didn't need to be cooked. And so the plan, the goal, the final cause, which is what telos is, by its nature, entails what has to happen to make it come into existence. So entailment is the requirement to fulfill the purpose. And so purpose is, I want a cup of coffee in the morning. My purpose is to have a cup of coffee in the morning. What does that entail? Well, it entails a coffee pot and some water and some coffee grounds and a filter and electricity. And so entailment simply is what is required to fulfill the purpose. And that's what that means. And what he said was, there is nothing in physics or chemistry that entails life. In other words, you can't make life out of chemicals in a test tube. You just can't. And believe me, they have tried and tried and tried and tried. It's not like, oh, I have a good idea. Let's make some organic molecules into a test tube and see if we can get a functional cell. They tried that for 50 years, billions of dollars of research, and they have failed. And that's because it can't be done. It can't be done because you're missing the ingredients that has to have it done. So I could pour water through my coffee filter forever and not have coffee come out until I put the coffee grounds in there. Or you could say I could watch my coffee maker full with coffee grounds and water and everything and never get coffee until I plug the cord in and connect it to the thing I'm missing, which is electricity, which drives the coffee maker.
Yeah, and so let's see. I wanted to ask you about something that shows up also on page 199. Let me take a look at that. On 199, you said you were talking about a TV special that had been on the Nature Channel, where they make this startling comment that Genesis, the story of the dynamic forces and crazy coincidences that took a bunch of dead ingredients and transformed them into something as wondrously intricate as life on Earth. And a little bit earlier, you had quoted Wendell Berry as saying, we are not getting something for nothing. We are getting nothing for everything. So, the atheists are saying you can start with dead ingredients and you can transform them into something as wondrously intricate as life on Earth with just this hand waving. In the past, the hand waving was all about random mutation and natural selection. And now some biologists are moving away from random mutation and natural selection because they realize that that's not really sufficient to explain it. But now they've switched over to the whole complexity idea that as long as you have disequilibrium, that explains everything. And so I wondered if you had anything to say about that.
I just looked at my watch and I'm enjoying this so much. We can certainly go on for 90 minutes if you have. I just told my staff to cool it until I come out of there. I had my schedule pretty clear, but things always pop up. You know, when I saw that that episode, and that's a quote, of the Discovery Channel, and poor Will Smith, they put those words in his mouth. But it says it all. Wait, your experience for the 10 trillion synapses in my brain is crazy coincidences? That's your science? That's your rigorous explanation? You're a joke. You're pathetic. You should go run and hide. Stop it. Enough. This is ridiculous. Inorganic ingredients, crazy coincidences? That's it? Now, it's true that Will Smith wasn't giving a science lecture, but they put words in his mouth which were to sum up their actual belief. You don't say, well, Jesus Christ was just a man. I didn't really mean that. He was the son of God. Yeah, I left that part out. Sorry. And the Discovery Channel had Stephen Hawking on, and I was so disappointed. It was such a horrible, embarrassing episode on his part that he contradicted everything he'd ever said before in his life just to get on the TV channel. And they promote these lies that the gullible, non-scientific audience looks at and goes, oh, my goodness, these smart people and this wonderful Will Smith, who I like a lot, are telling us to believe these things. The reason I wrote the book was because that paradigm is out there and it's in the media. So if anyone wants to overcome the lies and the misinformation coming out of the media on the Discovery Channel, read my book, please. And send me questions to my website, which is stephenyacoboni.com. It's easy enough. And we'll talk about it, but it's very sad. Now, you brought up the other point, which is actually when I wrote the book and was published in 2002, I started writing it about 5 years before then, because I have a full-time job. And I think good writing should be done intermittently, especially if you're thinking about philosophy and you want ideas to pop into your mind, which they do with me, I never thought in my lifetime, I thought, okay, you've written this book and the intelligent design and Christians and so on are going to think, oh, this is really good. But no one's going to take it seriously. 50 years from now, your kids could say, hey, my dad said this in 2022 and now you're all on board. He said it first, and I wasn't doing it to be famous. I wanted the message, but I never dreamed that the message, that the concept would actually gain traction in my lifetime. But now it turns out that there is a growing group of scientists, atheists, openly admitted atheists. I am an atheist scientists who are saying exactly what my book says, which is you cannot solve biology without teleology, period. Mm-hmm. And when they add that to their paradigm, they're making scientific discoveries no one dreamed of. And I'll give you an example. The leader, as far as I know, of this group is Michael Levin, L-E-V-I-N.
He's been on the channel a number of times. Yeah.
He's all over the place, and so it's easy to find. I think he's mm-hmm. at Tufts, and he has even said to his colleagues, how's that denial of teleology working for you guys? It's working for us because it's not working for us, so we embraced it. Now, here's the interesting thing, and this is where the atheism of the gaps gets really interesting, is that Levin, still an avowed atheist. And I only say that because he says it. I don't put words in anyone's mouth. He says it. They are trying to naturalize teleology, saying, oh, yeah, purpose is just a force of nature, which is what my book says, actually. I never dreamed that someone would say that a purposeful force of nature, which utterly contradicts the paradigm you've had for 100 years, starting with Darwin and going all the way up to E.O. Wilson and Richard Dawkins and all these people who say there is no purpose, actually, it's an illusion. That's their paradigm. So my book says there is purpose and it's a force of nature. Now they're saying, Dr. Iacoboni's right. There is purpose and it's a force of nature, but it's just a force of nature. Now, again, you could get back to, well, what is a force of nature? Where are their laws? Why are there laws? Can you have, I bet I could go somewhere, say there was a freeway in Antarctica. I could probably drive my car 200 miles an hour and not get pulled over. Because there are no traffic laws, or in Germany, there are no speed limits. The only reason there are laws is because there's a lawgiver. So when I go over the speed limit and I get pulled over, it's because some intellect made a rule that was enforceable. That's what a law is. So even if you call teleology a force of nature, which means that it's a law, it had to come from a designing intellect that said, I'm making this happen. Now, never mind that they had to totally abandon everything they tried to tell us for 100 years, but now they're trying to fall back on this other fantasy, and it is, for anyone honest and thoughtful, there can be no doubt that they are on the wrong side of this. Part of the reason why I wrote the first half of the book as a history lesson is to give people perspective as to what is why the scientists actually thought that your life has no purpose, like Bertrand Russell said, a universe in ruins, accidental co-location of atoms, utterly random and undesigned, which is what Dawkins and Dennett and E.O. Wilson and Jacques Monod all said. Now they're all wrong, and their colleagues are calling them wrong, and their colleagues are just saying, well, we're going to adopt Steve, or let's just say, the intelligent design community's point of view, and we're going to take it over for ourselves. Well, how do you explain purpose without an end in mind and a designer who had that end in mind? Remember, the point of purpose is to fulfill a need. So in organisms, for example, you have a digestive system so that you can take raw materials out of the world and turn it into things that go into your stomach that get broken down into energetic molecules that go into your bloodstream that give you the energy to live. And so there's only a purpose because there's an end in mind, a reason for it to happen. And so purpose really means that there is reason in the world. Reason has to come from an intellect. And so it's so simple that any fourth grader or every second grader easily understand this.
So at one point you start kind of combining the idea of telos with emergence. And I thought that was really interesting because we've talked a lot about emergence on the channel, weak emergence, strong emergence. I've had a number of conversations with a physicist who is also a believer, and he also talks about this idea of strong emergence as being very important. But the way you talked about emergence was different than I'd heard anybody else talk about it before. And I think, let me see here what your language was. In layman's terms, emergence is defined as the appearance of something unexpected and unforeseen. Because when the scientists talk about emergence, it's sort of like you have this bunch of random chemicals, and then at a certain point of disequilibrium, it becomes more than just a collection of chemicals. You have something more. It just emerges. But when you likened it to the idea of an emergency room, a person has an accident, an unforeseen, unpredictable accident, and then they end up in the emergency room because something emerged, an unexpected, unknown thing emerged. And that reminded me a lot of in Jordan Peterson's book, Maps of Meaning. He has a whole chapter, chapter four, on the idea of anomaly. And basically, that idea of anomaly is very coherent with this, the way that you're describing emergence. And I felt for a long time that anomalies are a gift. Anomalies are a given from God, because anomalies seem to suit the need of the moment in a way that is, you know, almost incomprehensible to our minds. An anomaly would be like maybe something happens to you. Maybe you get stuck in traffic, and then you find out later, oh, it was a great thing I was stuck in traffic, because if I hadn't been, this other thing would have happened. So that getting stuck in traffic was like a happy accident, right? It's an emerging property. And so I really like the way that you describe emergence, but do you want to go on and talk a little bit about how emergence fits in with your idea of telos?
No, I'd be glad to. And so one of the things, a couple things about my book, the first is that the first half of the book defines the history in short readable, very short readable chapters. And I go through all the major scientific founders, including E.O. Wilson, Jacques Monod, Charles Darwin, and others, so that people get the understanding of how we got to where we are. Because if you're stuck somewhere, like if you take a hike in the woods and then the cookie trail is eaten by birds, you can't find your way back unless you know how you got there. And then the second, but what's, and there's been a lot written about that. And so I only gave it a synopsis view for people to get the gist, which is that René Descartes and Isaac Newton, the fathers of modern science, were devout Christians who had no idea that their science would be turned into atheism. So I'm absolving them of that. But the second half of the book, what's really valuable about the second half of the book is that it answers the question. You didn't say, well, we have this problem and no one knows the answer. I give the answer. The answer is telos. And then you say, well, what is telos? Well, it's a force of nature that causes purpose to occur, and it's undeniable. You know, why do polar bears have webbed feet? So that they can swim 50 miles. Their ancestors were grizzly bears. Grizzly bears don't have webbed feet. Polar bears have white fur and black skin, white fur for camo, but they have black skin underneath to hold heat, and webbed feet so they can go chase seals. It's all purpose driven. Say, okay, it's purpose driven. How did that happen? And so that's where emergence ties in. And what's interesting about emergence was that, again, it's one of these things that the atheists had used to sort of trick us. And when you talk about to some intelligent design people, they don't like that word because it's used by the atheists to justify their gaps, meaning it was a wastebasket term. Something is an emergent property of molecules combining. And so we've explained it. We gave it a three-syllable word. And so they're hiding behind it. But actually, what's great about emergence is that it proves the whole point of telos, meaning that what is emergence? Well, so here's the paradigm example. You read this everywhere, but it's still worth knowing the paradigm example. Most of the time when you sit down to eat, you sprinkle a little bit of salt on your food, or it got put in whatever was cooked, sodium chloride. Sodium chloride is essential for life. Without it, nothing lives, period. What is sodium? Sodium is a volatile metal that when it's exposed to water, explodes. We had sodium metal in my chem lab, and it was in a jar full of oil. And the professor said, don't open that jar. You want the lab to blow up. What is chlorine? It's a poisonous gas. We all know poisonous gases have been used for in the past. You take two utterly noxious things, sodium, and you study all the properties of sodium until you're blue in the face. You'd be the greatest inorganic chemist in the world and go, this is what sodium is, and that's all that it is, and it can't be anything else. And you study chloride, and you go, this is chloride, and it is what it is, and it can't be anything else. And then you put them together, and you have something that life cannot live without. You cannot predict the property of sodium chloride if all you know about are the properties of sodium by itself or chloride by itself. And so this property of being the ionic master cylinder for life emerged when the two come in contact and the sodium ion attracts the chlorine electrons away from it and creates this ionic compound, which even when the sodium and chloride dissolve into your bloodstream as separate atoms, they no longer have the noxious properties that you were confronted with. That's emergence. Now, it is reducible to the chemistry. So, okay, now we understand why sodium chloride is what it is and does what it does. The whole point of emergence is not that it's something magical or mystical. Everything that's emergent can be reduced to its beginnings. At least you can see how it happened. Like, so even consciousness in a brain from the 10 trillion synapses is what we call the emergent property of a brain. Well, we know that it's there because there are 10 trillion synapses. And we know that there are 10 trillion synapses because there was a fertilized egg that made them. Now, we don't know how or what directed it. That's the point. And so I wanted to make it very clear in the book that I was not coming up with some mystical, God did it, magical, woof, here's life thing. I grounded it in scientific language, telos is a force of nature. But I also actually said later, it's actually a complementarity. It's an ontological connection between life and spirit. That's really what telos is. I'm writing another book to further define it because you can't put everything in the first book, but what emergence actually displays is something that Michael Behe, professor in Pennsylvania, who's famous for his books, including Darwin's Black Box, is that you can see how an egg turns into a human with a brain, but you can't say how. You can't reduce it to a series of chemical reactions that led to that complexity. And that's how he came up with the notion of irreducible complexity. Almost everything in a living organism, even in E. coli, is complex beyond reducibility. Behe's paradigm was the flagellum. You have this little tail, it whips the cell around and it senses a nutrient gradient. And it goes up the nutrient gradient so that it can get more food. And that's all a fact. How does it get there? Well, it has a little motor behind the boat that spins and sends it up the nutrient gradient. Well, it turns out that this motor is constructed of 40 different proteins, all of which have to come from a different part of the cell, from a different part of the DNA. They all have to be connected together properly and just right. And that all happens. We can write out the chemical equations as to how that happened. So the function of flagellum, you look flagellum and you look it up on Wikipedia, it's elegant, it's beautiful. This is a prokaryote, this is E. coli. But the point is, how did the molecules that preceded the first bacterium know, well, we have to build a flagellum. We have to have all these proteins to create the motor and the disc and the tail. We have to put all these things together, and they all have to be put together just at the right time and just in the right order in order for us to have a flagellum so that we can go up a nutrient gradient and stay alive. Now, the fact is E. coli does that, and we see the chemical reactions that do that. We see the genes that code for the proteins. But how did the molecules know they had to have those genes that coded for the proteins that made everything fit in exactly the right way? And we're talking about the most primitive life form evolve a single cell B. coli that doesn't even have a nucleus. And then you're talking about 10 trillion synapses in a 10 trillion synapses in a human brain. And a synapse is no small thing. It's what guides everything inside you. And they all have to get put together by this one cell with its 46 chromosomes. Now it happened, and I studied embryology, and you can see the cell turn into 2 to 8 to 16 and so on, and then they go off into different areas. So you have different types of tissue, the mesoderm, the ectoderm, and the endoderm. And then they go off on their little pathways to create the things that they create, the blood vessels and the bones and the kidneys and everything. There's a plan in there. There's a force. That's all you can say. It's a mystical, ontological, spiritual entity guiding all of this. And it's not anywhere in physics or chemistry, period. You can look at it, but you can't say, well, what is the organizing principle behind all this? Any artifact that you look at, from a jet to a cell phone to a pencil to a toaster, you say, this was designed by somebody who had in mind ahead of time, this is what I want to make. And that's the whole point of telos. Telos in English language means final cause, meaning what was the final purpose you were willing to, you wanted to accomplish when you started out to do this thing. I want a house. The house just doesn't put it, you don't put a seed in the ground and a house pops up. You have to say, I want lumber and I want plumbing and I want wiring and I want concrete and I want bricks and I want tile and I want roofing. And you have to say, and I want the house to have so many bedrooms and in this location and this and that. All of that design has to happen before this, you fulfill the final cause, the final purpose, which is a place to live in. And so everything made, there's no such thing as a thing that was made without a design. And there's nothing in the artifact world, even the Large Hadron Collider, is trivial in complexity compared to a single human cell.
Well, so as I understand your thesis, and forgive me if I don't explain it very well, is that even at the molecular level, there is already existing the potential for this telos to be a part of living organisms. So the molecules themselves have, I won't put the word intelligence on it, but the molecules have something in them that is inherent that is going to permit this telos to move through the evolutionary process to produce, to get to the end of things with the human brain. And forgive me if I missed something as I was reading the book, but that sounds almost a little bit to me like a kind of a deism, like things were set in place at the beginning. The design was there at the beginning, and then it just sort of plays itself out over time until we get to where we are. Or is there some interaction with us during this process of development?
I'm really glad you brought this up. So when you talk about, the other key concept is intentionality, which was what you were sort of looking at. And so one of the great atheist biologists of the 20th century, a guy named Ernst Mayr, M-A-Y-R, has written 10 books, maybe more. Sort of wanted to be the Darwin of the 20th century. Maybe he was. He was a very highly respected scientist. He said, it may look like when a bird goes to get a worm that it's acting intentionally, but actually what's happening is there's a chemical in the bird's stomach that sends a message to the brain saying, I'm hungry, which motivates the bird to flap its wings and use its eyes to find the worm. It goes down, plucks it, and eat it. In other words, they were reducing it all to a series of biological actions. And actually, yes, that's true. And so if you try to argue intentionality on the part of large organisms, it's obvious. I mean, you can't deny that sharks go eat things and humans eat nachos on Super Bowl day, and skunks spray you when they are afraid of you. and so on. Yes, everything in the macroscopic living world is intentional. And it sort of loses its mystery because, you know, well, they're just doing what they need to do to survive. See, Darwin was right. Well, all, you know, survival of the fittest is the truism of all truisms. Those that are able to survive are the ones that are survived. There's no definition of fitness. It's also, and I'll say this even though it's been said so many times before, Darwin's title of his book is a misnomer, The Origin of Species. He never talked about the origin of species. He just talked about when you have a species, how does it change it to another one? So the origin of the new species might have been the way to talk about that. The thing that really, again, turned the page for me and should turn the page for others is that this intentionality exists in molecules. We can all understand a dog barking because it hears somebody at the front door it doesn't know. We can understand a snake going after a mouse because it's hungry. But at the intracellular level, the intentionality of molecules, which we think by our paradigm, have no capacity to think or act with function. They just do what they do because they're molecules. They act with an intentionality that is actually more complicated, more intricate, and more astounding than a dog barking at the door or a snake catching a mouse. And so here then you're forced, if you're an atheist, to explain how come molecules are intentional. You know, you used to say, well, DNA just is what it is, and it's transcribed into RNA, which is transported over to the ribosome, which turns it into a protein. It's just a series of chemical reactions. That's what I thought when I was, that's what I was taught in the 60s and the 70s when I turned to atheism. Now we know it's not like that at all. 97% of the DNA does not transcribe into proteins. They're transcribed into regulator molecules, which tell the DNA what to do and when to do it, and how to do it. And when the DNA is transcribed into a protein, into an RNA, it doesn't just go to the ribosome. There's something called a spliceosome. This is, let me take a look at this thing you've got here. Well, that's not quite right. This amino acid's in the wrong place. This nucleotide needs to go over there. It chops up the transcribed DNA and puts it together so that it's presentable to the ribosome, like your mother making you tuck in your shirt and comb your hair before you go out on a date because you're not quite ready for it, to go meet your girlfriend at the ribosome. That's all a fact. These molecules are acting with intentionality that is beyond description. So for example, like I said, 97% of the DNA is not transcribed into protein, but when it is transcribed, it is all transcribed. And then the spliceosome has to take the strand of DNA that was transcribed into RNA and chop off the parts that are on, and 97% of it is not supposed to code for anything. It has to reconnect all of the nucleotides back together so that the ribosome can interpret it. This is a molecule that is editing the editing of the editing. It's a molecule. How does it do that? How does it know that? And it doesn't just do it mechanically, because if it's hot outside, the ribosome will say, we don't actually need something to make you hotter. Here, I'm going to take this RNA that you transcribed and turn it into something that cools your core. And it'll take a set of genes and rearrange them because it's hot outside. The molecules are thinking. They're thinking, they are intentional, and there's nothing that you can, in the paradigm, accept that this is organized by a brain and an intellect that is beyond our fathoming. Now, getting back to your question of deism and all that, I'm going to beg beyond my pay grade. My purpose of my book was simply to get people to understand that there is an organizing principle and a design principle and an intellect underpinning everything that we say and do every microsecond of every day. And you can put that where you want. I prefer to Christians, but the same thing for Muslims and Jews and everyone else who believes in some sort of organizing principle. You know, I studied Taoism for a while, when I left Christianity, because I had a void and I had to fill it somehow. And you know, Taoism is basically this: there's an organizing principle. We can't name it. Just like the word TAO and GOD, there are no other words like those words. They are made intentionally to be nonsensical. So you can't call God Leroy or a fence, and you can't call the Tao a horse or a star. It had to be a word that had no attachment to any other word, so that it remained undefinable. And the whole purpose of Taoism is to say you cannot define it. To grasp Taoism is to lose it. Or as St. Francis of Assisi said, you cannot understand that the concept of three persons in one God is beyond your comprehension. It's a mystery. And having said that, I want to say something about Wendell Berry, whose book changed my life. Read his book before you read mine. Then you'll understand my book. Life is a Miracle. I was searching. I was scared. I didn't know what. And this book fell out of the bookshelf. It landed in my hands. I wrote Wendell Berry a letter, and he wrote me back in pencil, in cursive. And I treasure that little letter saying, thank you so much, Stephen. I have my own beliefs that are formed by, you know, how I was formed. I believe in Jesus Christ and that he wants to make things happen. It's a mystery we can't understand. Remember what Thomas Aquinas, St. Thomas Aquinas says, you could believe in God because of revelation. Of course, that's what our religion is. But, you know, you can also believe in God just by looking at the world around you and infer from the complexity and the purposefulness of the world around us that there is a God. And it is important to know that Aquinas had a hard time studying Aristotle, because a lot of what Aquinas did, at least with respect to his Summa Theologia, comes from Aristotle. And you weren't supposed to study Aristotle in the 14th century, 13th century, because he was a pagan. And you can't study that stuff. In fact, they suppressed it. Aquinas had to leave Italy to go to Paris, where they allowed him to study it. And Aquinas basically Christianized Aristotle. And again, he said, reason leads us to believe these things. The only way to understand this is to make the inference. And so, like William Dembski, who wrote The Design Inference, says it's just 10 to the 50th. You can't have it. There must be a design to lower the odds. Or as Stephen Meyer, the director of the Discovery Institute, said, it's what we call abductive reasoning. In other words, you see a set of circumstances and you have to say you walk outside and you had a car parked in the driveway and it's all wet. You say, I wonder how the car got wet. Well, it could be that it rained. But if nothing else is wet, then you rule out that it rained. And then you see a trail of water leading to the hose. You go, somebody sprayed my car with a hose, and that's how you solve it. You don't prove it, you don't see it, you don't video it, but it's simple reasoning. And that's what's so great about this, is you don't have to be a PhD in physics to understand any of this. Like I said, you ask anybody who doesn't know anything about science, and you say, you know that polar bears are descendants from grizzly bears, which they are, because they have some interbreeding in the genetics and so on. But you know that polar bears are distinct from grizzly bears because they have webbed feet and their hair is white instead of black, brown, so that they can hide, and that they can smell a seal under the ice 10 miles away. You think that's just sort of happened? There's a grizzly bear one day who had a great sense of smell and got covered in white paint, and somebody taped up his feet so he could swim. No, they go, of course not. It was nature designed it. Yes, you can call it nature if you want. And I adore, I worship nature, because nature comes from the designer of the design, which is, as to quote Aquinas, as the hand moves, it is moved by the arm, which is moved by the man, which is moved by another, until we come to the one who is unmoved, the unmoved mover. That's my theology. And the unmoved mover is that which we call God.
So one of the other terms that you talked about that modern atheist scientists are using as a explanation is this whole idea of self-organization. And so, well, before we get there, let me just point to something on page 217 for people who are going to buy the book and follow along here. You said one day we got to talking about what's real and what is not. I confided in her. I think this is one of your patients. Oh, it was the wife of a patient. I confided in her that I was coming to consider things I never thought I could have believed in just 5 years before. And that's when she said to me, "That is truly wonderful, Stephen, because it's not that seeing is believing, but rather that you have to believe it in order to see it." And that made me think about many of the talks that Jordan Peterson has given about perception. He's a psychologist. I don't know if you've heard.
I know who he is, yeah.
And he said, he said, the world reveals itself in accordance with our aim. That is what perception is. And in other speeches, he has talked about the idea that you have to have an aim before you can perceive anything. And that aim is actually based on a value scale. One thing is better than another thing. Otherwise, you would never move forward. If there's no reason to move forward, you would never move forward. And that reason has to be a value scale. So basically, he says that meaning precedes matter. So the meaning has to be there even before matter can arise.
Oh, that's so fantastic. Just to go back to what was that quote you said, it really opened my eyes. That, and I tell people, it's not that seeing is believing. You have to believe in order to see it. And you can talk to somebody till they're blue in the face, but if they have a certain mindset, then they're not going to believe it until they open their minds to what you're presenting to them. And there's a famous quote by a great scientist, William L. Sasser, who has a big display at Johns Hopkins where he was. I don't know his religious proclivities, but he tried to solve the problem of life as a physicist. And he said, there have to be biotonic laws that we don't know about. And he said, the difficulty we scientists all have in understanding this is because we have been indoctrinated since we are grade school to believe that that isn't true. And when you are indoctrinated in something, it's very hard to give it up, especially if your livelihood or your pride or your profession is at stake. Now, getting to the other thing you said, which is pretty deep and actually pretty important, and is going to be discussed in greater detail in my next book. When I was in college and studying biochemistry, the paradigm was structure determines function. So if you want to have methane, which is natural gas, you have to have a carbon atom surrounded by four hydrogen atoms. And it is the fact that these atoms all came together to make this molecule is the reason you have natural gas. It was the random association of the atoms that made the function. I have to give credit where credit is due. Robert Rosen says very clearly, everyone's got it backwards. Function defines structure. And everything that is designed follows that rule. In other words, you don't build an airplane without wings. Well, there are some flying wings, but they're wings still. You don't build an airplane without wings. You say, I want to fulfill a function. I want to be able to have a craft that takes me up in the sky. Well, okay, I need to fulfill that function, which is the first thing. I need a structure. I'll come up with wings. That's how that works. And so the matter structure defines function comports with the atheism notion that you can have molecules randomly jostle themselves into the wind up in a certain structure which gives them their function. So DNA, it just happens to be a bunch of atoms that turned into this, randomly finally found themselves in this structure. And it is the structure of the DNA that leads it to be the coding device of all living things, this one molecule. Well, and so that paradigm fits their paradigm, which was the randomness selection process. Molecules join themselves randomly, and when they find themselves in a functional array, then function emerges out of that. Now we know that the function is so intricate and so detailed and so complex that there could be no such notion that, for example, you built a jetliner out of scraps that blow through a junkyard, that there had to be an organizing principle that says, I'm going to create molecules that join together to create a code to design the body parts of every living thing. Now, here's something that isn't heard very often. It needs to be said. If you're talking to an atheist who says, well, it's all random and it's all, he said, wait a minute. DNA is a code. It's not a chemical reaction. It's a code. The whole point of four molecules, AGCTT, adenine, guanine, uracil, thymidine, cytosine, that make up DNA and RNA. These four molecules encode for the body plan and the parts and everything else about every single creature, plant, animal, and bacterium that ever existed in every environment in the history of the world. Four molecules created a code for dinosaurs, flies, dandelions, ants, people, frogs, and Clostridium. It's a code, and the only reason they can do that is because the code is not a chemical reaction. It has to be interpreted. In other words, if A and B create C, that's a chemical reaction. But if A says, well, we could go B, C, D, E, or F, and something has to choose, that's a code. Now, everyone understands codes because that's what written language is. You take 27 letters and you are able to create every single word ever written in whatever language you're talking about that uses our alphabet or any other alphabet. It's part of the reason why the ideographs of Asia are so cumbersome, because they're not phonemic, they're pictures. Anyway, it's not a chemical reaction. It's a thought out code. There has to be some thinking that made the code. You don't just start saying, you don't write down A, B, F, G, U, I, X, W, expect you to understand what I said. I have to think about THAT, ISCAT, that is a cat. And now you know what I'm talking about, but it's all gibberish if you don't speak English. It's a code that is interpreted. Life runs on a code, and this code is not a chemical reaction, because if it was a chemical reaction, you couldn't have the diversity. In other words, every DNA molecule can make any encode for any gene it wants to, because it's not constrained by physical or chemical forces that make the code interpreted into something else. It's like all the letters in the alphabet can be turned into any letter you want, because you can take ABC, you can take CAT, and you can write cat, or you can write tack, depending on how you want to arrange the words. So these are letters in an alphabet that are free to assemble in all different ways so that you can have all the diversity of life. I'm talking about five fish in a fishbowl. I'm talking about the dinosaurs from 500 million years ago, and the penguins in Antarctica, and the bacteria in your gut, and the snakes in the swamps, and everything in between. These four, five nucleotides code for that because it is an open-ended system. And you can take the 26 letters that we're both familiar with, and you can write all the new words you want ad infinitum. There's no end to it because it's open-ended. It's not governed by a chemical force that says AGCT must be interpreted to DCDEF. It's not like that. It's a code. And that you can't have randomness and unintentionality without that. It is the science of purpose. It's so simple. That's the theme of the book. Purpose is now a scientific fact. I've written 15 articles on it in Evolution News from the Discovery Institute. I call it the Science of Purpose Project, and that's what this is. We're not talking about, I'm not a theologian. There are lots of great theologians and clerics, and they need to do what they do. I believe them, but I'm a scientist, so I'm doing what I know, and I want to be as smart about it as I can. So I stick to science, and it is the science of purpose. And once you understand that there is a science that verifies and proves purpose in your life, then you must understand that your life has purpose and that purpose was intended.
Well, and you know, the fact that we only have a couple minutes left here, because I know you have to go soon, that you have taken this idea of purpose and you begin to apply it to your cancer research and your cancer care of patients as well. And that's just very exciting to think about.
It's been very, very exciting. Medical research is paradigm based, and there are breakthroughs from time to time. I've been doing this for 40 plus years, and I'm a bit frustrated that we haven't conquered the disease that I thought we would conquer 20 years ago. And there are reasons why we haven't been able to do that, which I believe should be investigated. The decisions about what happens in the medical industry is made by bureaucrats. We saw that in the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
And they have lots of interests, including public health, but also geopolitical concerns. We don't want to start a war. We don't want to make false accusations. We want to help as many people as we can. We don't really know what happened. We do the best we can, but they got a lot of the science wrong, and we all know that, and I don't blame them. You know, what concerns all of us is that they said that it was proven science and we had to shut up and not disagree with them. I know Jordan Peterson's gotten into a lot of trouble for saying, no, wait a minute, I get to disagree. This is a free society. It's not Stalinist Russia, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so I have in my book some ideas about how to make cancer care better, because I think there is room for improvement, as a lot of people would say who've experienced it. So that's another sort of added bonus, plus the poetry. I hope listeners will be encouraged to take a look at my website, which is stepheniacoboni.com, Stephen with a P-H, I-A-C-O-B-O-N-I. You can order a signed copy of the book if you buy it from me directly, send me an email, or you can just buy it off of Amazon or Christian Books, etc. And also read the book, and you can read and you can ask me questions online. I'd love to answer those questions. A lot of the questions are really good. It seems like people are really catching on, and it's very, very encouraging. And I'm very grateful for having the chance to spend the time with you today.
Oh, I'm so thankful that you were willing to join me. And is it okay if I put your email address in the description section?
No, absolutely.
Okay, that's great. And
Stephenyacoboni.com is the email, but the website which takes you to the email is just Stephenyacoboni.com.
I will put both those in there, and I'll also look up the articles on discovery because I think that would be really fascinating. And before I leave, I want to remind everybody that I'll be speaking at a conference in at the Pacific Northwest Estuary Conference in Olympia, Washington, on September 13th and 14th. And I'll put the link to that as well in the description section. So this has been great. I hope you might join me again sometime. I might try to find another scientist to talk with you and have a very interesting conversation together.
That would be just great. I would be very happy to do that.
Okay. Thank you so much and have a wonderful day.
Thank you, Karen. You too. God bless you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.